court is ready to hear argument in 03-1128, Sandy Dew and Others versus Crown Derrick Erectors, Inc.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Paul Dew fell through an unprotected open hole during the construction of one of the world's largest offshore oil derricks. To protect the hole in the rig that it was building, Crown Derrick strung a rope across some handrails. Instead of placing a cover over the hole or a permanent barrier as was required. Why was that negligent? Because the rope was temporary, and because the rope could be moved, and because it was not a cover as required. Crown Derrick's only answer to that negligence is to say that the rope was moved, and that moving it was a new and independent cause.
Why was the jury charged with obstruction?
Your Honor, we don't believe the jury charge was erroneous. The jury charge wasn't erroneous because in two different places it talked about causation involving the very actor that Crown Derrick now says was the new and independent cause, and that's wrong. But Crown Derrick's answer that there is a new and independent cause in this case and that it was entitled to a different charge is wrong for at least two reasons. First, it's not legally entitled to a new and independent cause instruction under either current Texas law or under the third restatement draft. And secondly, it's not entitled to reversal in any event because the lack of that instruction didn't cause any harm. Turning first to the argument on whether this was raised by the evidence, the court can ask the same question that it did in 1937 in the new and independent cause case called Young versus Massey, and that is the question of whether the charge is erroneous turns on the question of whether there's evidence to support it. And under both current Texas law and under the new restatement draft, new and independent cause just is not presented here. Proximate cause requires foreseeability. New and independent cause requires a complete lack of foreseeability. And the very tender that Crown Derrick made in this case said that it was an action by a new and independent agency that was not reasonably foreseeable. And it was, as a matter of law, we submit, foreseeable that Crown Derrick's rope that was strung across these handrails, and some of the pictures of this kind of rope are in the oral argument handouts behind tab A, you can see what this looks like. And whether this is the rope that was there on the day of the accident or the rope that it strung, any rope across a hole like this is inviting movement, is demanding that it be moved in an open construction site like this, building an oil derrick that's 170 feet tall, that people have got to walk around. There's a hole in the platform, and a rope barrier is not compliant with any of the standards that govern this conduct. It's not permanent. It doesn't have a top, middle, and a tow board railing. The OSHA standards...
Now I see the picture. How do you walk around the hole? It looks like there are guardrails on either side of it. How do you get around the hole at all? Is there another way around? You have to go all the way back around the rig?
Well, there's really not, and that's one of the dangerous things about it, Justice Oman, is that you have to come around the corner and turn left, as Paul Dew would have had to have done in this case. You have to come around and turn left around this corner, and the hole is really behind that big girder that you see.
My point is that there are ropes around it, but it's not like you just can, like the grocery store and there are cones up, you just walk further to the right and walk around. It looks like that the only way you can get to the other side is to reverse course and go all the way back around something. Is that correct?
I think that's exactly right. You would have had to turn around and go completely around the other side, retrace your steps, so to speak, probably. And it's very...
You can't just step around it.
Well, it's not really clear how he got around it, but I don't think anybody could really... You can step across the hole. It's only about 30 inches or 31 inches wide. So you can step across it if you can get past the ropes or if you can fall into the ropes or if the ropes aren't there. And that's the point, is that the hole is there in any event, no matter how long the ropes stay, the hole is always there. And there's no reason why one of these pieces of grating that you see in the second page of the exhibit, why one of those pieces of grating couldn't have been taken by Crown Derrick and tacked down over the hole, or why it couldn't have gone to the hardware store and bought some bolts or some other hardware that would have been necessary to do something more than just put a temporary rope barrier that was inviting movement from the very moment that it was strung there.
Of course, a gate would invite movement in that sense.
Well, a gate in this case was designed to be moved, but it would have been permanent, and it would have precluded people from falling through the hole.
Not if you left it open.
Well, but it's the kind of a thing, Your Honor, as I appreciate the evidence and the record in this case, although I didn't see the diagram, but it seems to me that what this is some sort of a hinge, that it's on a hinged opening and can be closed. And so if it's closed, it's closed if you have to walk across it. The point is here, it could never be closed.
It seems to me that if you have a hole 170 feet high that somebody falls through, it's not going to be very hard to argue that whatever was done was not good enough because you shouldn't have fallen through the hole.
Well, I think certainly more could have been done at a minimum, something permanent.
So then the question is there some end of foreseeability? Because if you make a hole in a walkway like this, 170 feet high, it just seems to me sort of it's somewhat foreseeable that somebody is going to fall through that hole. Gates, guards, welding, bolts, ropes, whatever you put around it, it just is it's a problem.
Well, the brackets that the new restatement would put on that is to ask the question, what was it that made this negligent? It was negligent to use a temporary rope. Then did the harm that was caused by that negligence, is it within the scope of the kind of thing that made it negligent in the first place? And in this event, we say, yes, it was. Clearly, to put up a temporary rope, to string it across the handrails when it could be moved, and to not put a cover down, is somebody falling through that hole the kind of thing that's within the scope of risk of what made it negligent to use the rope in the first place? And the answer has to be yes. Same question on foreseeability. Is it foreseeable that this would happen? The answer is yes. And it must be unforeseeable for there to be a new and independent cause.
But I guess my point is, isn't it awfully hard to make it unforeseeable? Isn't it awfully hard to have a hole that is something that you can crawl through to get to a ladder, I guess, and go someplace else, and not have at least a distinct possibility that somebody's going to fall through and hurt themselves very badly?
No, because and another way to ask that question is, isn't it always going to be hard to get a new and independent cause instruction? Well, the answer is, I think, no, not always. If somebody were standing there and Paul Dew walked up to the edge of the hole and they intentionally pushed him into the hole and he fell through, I'm not sure that that's foreseeable. The intervening act that would be criminal and intentional of the third party, perhaps that's not. Perhaps that is unforeseeable.
Well, according to the restatement example, it's not about that. I think it gives the example of someone who digs a hole in the middle of the street and someone intentionally shoves them into it. And so it says that's foreseeable.
It says that that might raise a fact question in certain instances. That's right. But it would be for this court to say, in any event under Texas law, whether that's foreseeable or not. And this court said in the Pena case that those sorts of intervening criminal acts are, as a matter of law, unforeseeable. And our intervening causes and superseding causes as a matter of law. In the Pena case, the court said that. In the case of Union Pump versus Albritton, the court said that on producing cause. In the case of Lear-Shigler versus Perez, the court said that. The court has not had trouble in saying when it is, as a matter of law, not foreseeable, or when it is, as a matter of law, an intervening or superseding cause. The court didn't have any trouble saying that at all.
Would there have been any harm in giving this instruction?
Would there have been harm in giving it?
If the judge had given it,
I suppose
the jury had answered zero, would you have a valid argument on appeal that the judge shouldn't give this instruction?
I believe we would, Your Honor, because our position would be that it's conclusively established that it was foreseeable to do this and that the instruction would have tilted or nudged the jury in the direction of the defendant's case and that we weren't entitled, given the charge that we were entitled to have. It's certainly harmful. It's certainly not harmful to not have given this charge because look what you have in the percentage question. And if you look behind tab B of the handout, you'll see the very argument that's being made about what the new independent cause is. It's all about Rowan, who was the owner of the derrick. Rowan did this, and Rowan did that, and Rowan was the intervening cause, and the six factors that are in the secondary statement that are cited in the Pena opinion. Are these six factors all discussing the conduct of another party who was submitted in the comparative question? And Rowan's conduct was found by the jury to have caused 47% of the accident or the injuries. So for Crown Derrick to say when it was only found 20% that it didn't get to talk about Rowan or it didn't get to argue the new and independent cause is just not true.
So if the new and independent cause is one of the co-defendants in the case, then it's not error to not submit it, or it's error but harmless error?
In the case of the new and independent cause
of the defendant, if the new and independent causer, new and independent cause actor, is a defendant in the case, because then there being the negligence question and the comparative fault, is it right. not error?
We wouldn't take the position that you can't have a new and independent cause instruction when the new and independent cause is alleged to be the party. But what we're saying in this case is that the charge took care of that. And further, I mean, under the new restatement, they talk.
So it would be error if error, but harmless.
I think we could make the argument either way, either that it is not error to refuse it, or that if it is error legally, that it's harmless. We can say it either way.
And the new do the broad form submission apply to inferential rebuttal instructions?
I'm sorry, does broad form submission?
Does broad form submission, we've got all these little inferential, should it apply? Does it? Aware of any case that's ever said so?
That the
broad form submission applies to inferential rebuttal.
Well, sure. Broad form cases submitted on broad form often have inferential rebuttal instructions. Yes, is that what you're asking?
And I'm asking should there be? Aren't they kind of the granulated thing?
I think what he means is can you combine all the inferential rebuttal issues into a broad form inferential rebuttal issue?
Well,
just as you do now.
You could have a charge as long as you want to have. You could have a charge that for the plaintiff said, and don't forget that there were brakes and speed and lookout alleged. And for the defendant, you could allege, well, new and independent cause, concurring cause, new and intervening cause, superseding cause.
But the reason we did broad form was to avoid reversals and trying cases numerous times because of the sweet little things that people arguably should have put in.
That's right. And you know, I think you can have constant remands for new trials if you want. But the question is that good policy? And we submit it's really not good policy.
Well, but the policy isn't the policy that there have to be some limits on liability. And so we don't want just an academic endless spectrum. We want a category. So you go this far,
sure.
And sure, you can keep extending it. But at this point, we're just going to say, for the good of the world,
right.
Life's too short, 5% or whatever number, that's it.
And the courts made that judgment in the cases I've cited, the Lear-Siegler case, the Albritton case, and the Pena case.
Does the scope of the risk formulation do that?
It does a better job, we submit, than current Texas law.
Why?
But even it does a better job because it focuses back on the core issues of negligence and what made it negligent in the first place, something that juries understand better, something that we think judges understand better, and something that gets rid of all these accretions and barnacles that have been put onto the doctrine of what's negligence and what does cabin liability in the correct places. In fact, the new restatement would say that in cases of superseding cause in a comparative responsibility world like Chapter 33 in Texas, you don't need all these things like new and independent cause and superseding cause and all of those things because the jury is asked to apportion liability. And those things that arose in the days of pure or of absolute bars for contrib and absolute joint and several liability, you don't need them as much anymore when you're finding the percentage. And
but,
so we've done away with those things.
But even finding percentages, jurors who are lay people and who don't familiarize themselves with these things need to be sort of coaxed or told, needs to be suggested for them. The answer can be zero, the answer can be 100. Just because there's five here doesn't mean you have to split it up five way. I mean, these are questions that lay people ask that the charge needs to speak to, it seems to me.
Well, but did the charge fairly do it in a way that gave all the parties the right to have their case submitted? And that's a question of the harmfulness. And clearly it's not harmful if they got to talk about Rowan, and they did. And that's in the charge. And in the new era of comparative responsibility, there's just no place for all of these inferential rebuttal submissions, especially not in a broad form world.
Thank you, counsel. Pardon me. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Allen York, to present argument from the respondent.
May it please the Court. The two issues raised by petitioners in this case have at least one thing in common. They both ask this Court to turn its back on precedential, established precedent in Texas negligence.
Most of the cases that both of y'all cite deal with the pre-comparative responsibility world, and particularly the more recent amendments where you can submit non-parties negligence. And it seems to me that maybe there's some overkill here if we continue to put in inferential rebuttal issues and comparative responsibility charges.
Justice Owen, the reason that I think that we are dealing with two different things goes to the very definition of what an inferential rebuttal issue is, which is it's something that negates a specific and essential element of the plaintiff's cause of action. In this situation, an independent cause goes to negate the idea of proximate cause, which is subsumed in the first question that is submitted to the jury. The way that this jury was charged was, did the negligence of any of the following parties proximately cause the injuries in question? And so the inferential rebuttal issue of new and independent cause goes directly to negating that element of proximate cause. What the petitioners are arguing is that we should subsume those inferential rebuttal issues into the comparative question, which is question two. There are several problems with that, but foremost is that under current Texas law, we do not submit to the jury the idea of comparative negligence. We submit to the jury the idea of comparative responsibility. In other words, we ask in question number two, of the parties that you have found to be negligent in question number one, apportion the responsibility of those parties for the injury in question.
It seems like you're getting two bites of the apple already in this charge on causation, because it seems to me you can argue on question one that, you know, we were negligent. We will concede that we should put something other up than rope, but our negligence did not proximately cause the occurrence because Rowan did all these things afterwards. So you can argue that on one. And then again on two, you can say, well, even if you find that we were negligent, what we did didn't attribute any at all to the occurrence in question. It seems to me you've got ample opportunity, particularly when all the actors who were allegedly negligent are in here, to say, no, put it off on Rowan, not on us. And why do you need what might be a nudge? And one more clue to the jury that you can zero out one of these defendants.
I think the problem here, Justice Owen, is that there were no nudges to the jury. There was no proper charge of the law to the jury. And Justice Heck pointed out that it's a problem if you're asking the jury, for example, in this question, to say, yes, that Crown Derrick was negligent in question number one, but answer 0% as to the apportionment of responsibility. It's counterintuitive to what the jury has just found in question number one, especially if there is no instruction from the court that instructs the jury that they are allowed to find that. Secondly, returning to the first part of that question, which is, don't we get to argue that under the first question in terms of, well, even if we were negligent, we still weren't the cause? We didn't get to argue that with the strength of a proper charge from the court. In fact, that's what new and independent cause specifically would have allowed Crown Derrick to argue to the jury. As the court has...
I don't understand why. You say you can't argue with the strength of the charge from the court, but there's going to be a general definition of instruction about cause, and you can get up there and say we couldn't proceed if it's going to happen.
Well, Your Honor, except that the inferential rebuttal issue again goes to say to set up a situation where Crown Derrick can say, even if you find that we were negligent, there still was no proximate cause. We could not have been the proximate cause because of this new and independent cause.
Are you saying that even if it's foreseeable, there can be a new and independent cause?
No, Your Honor. We can see that current Texas case law requires that for new and independent cause to be applicable, it cannot be something that was foreseeable. And, for example, in your opinion, I think the opposing counsel is calling opinion, I refer to it as Van Son. This court addressed the six factors that would be looked at for foreseeability. In other cases, such as Bell versus Campbell, this court has also dealt with the foreseeability question, dealing with injuries in kind and foreseeability issues such as that. But I want to point the court's attention to a specific opinion from the Dallas court.
Well, but the charge does specifically say, in order to be a proximate cause, the act or omission complained of must be, takes foreseeability into account, doesn't it?
It takes foreseeability, but it does not include the idea that there could be a causative break.
It says would have foreseen.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so you're free to argue that, look, we never foresaw that Rowan would untie these ropes. You can argue that to the jury.
Well, Your Honor.
Why do you need another instruction that emphasizes that?
We're not arguing on foreseeability, honestly, Your Honor, because we agree that, again, under current Texas law, in order for us to be entitled to new and independent cause, it must be something that was not foreseeable. Our argument is that new and independent cause goes to negate the causation element. It's a causal break instruction. It instructs the jury that even if you find that Crown Derrick was negligent in the actions that it took up to August 28th, when it tied the ropes up on the bit to barricade this hole that was in the Forble platform, you can still find, according to the instructions of the court, that that was not the cause of the injury that was suffered by Mr. Derrick.
I cannot get my mind around that argument. I mean, how would you be negligent by putting a rope up but for it being foreseeable that it could be removed? I mean, what's the negligence factor at all?
Well, Your Honor, it is certainly, I mean, I would concede that when you put a rope barrier up, it is certainly possible, I think as Justice Heck pointed out, that someone could potentially come and take that rope down. But as the Dallas Court of Appeals in Coleman held, what's not foreseeable is that when you leave a barrier such as that, when you leave a condition, and you advise someone who is responsible and in charge of the work site of the dangerous condition, what is not foreseeable is that if the condition becomes dangerous, that they will take no action to correct it.
Well, that applies to you too. I mean, you had an obligation to make this safe, and which you admit, you say you did so by putting up the rope. And the evidence appears to be that the space could be spanned by stepping over it, and that you can't just simply walk around it. So doesn't it seem foreseeable that average workmen up there or who want to get to the other side in a hurry, you're going to take this rope down and try to step over it and might fall through it?
Actually, Your Honor, what the evidence supports in this record is that the rope barrier that was erected by Crown Derrick is significantly different from the pictures that have been provided to you.
But even with the rope barrier you put up, isn't it foreseeable that someone, a workman, would untie it and try to span the gap by walking across it?
Potentially so, but again, we return to the idea of how foreseeability in a situation just as this has been addressed by the Dallas Court of Appeals and, in fact, is specifically addressed in the Restatement Third of Torts that petitioners are arguing should be applied here. Even in the Restatement Third of Torts, it is acknowledged that when a condition exists on a premises that has been safeguarded and then something happens afterward to make it unsafe, and the person who is responsible...
But see, you're arguing that you safeguarded it, and that goes to negligence, not proximate cause, and... That's I think, where Judge O'Neill are asking about. If the negligence is that the rope barrier you erected in the first place was not adequate, then you have not adequately safeguarded it. It's a question of negligence.
And Your Honor, that goes to the whole heart of the necessity for the new independent cause, because we did have the opportunity to argue at trial that by erecting the double rope barrier that the evidence supports would have prevented anyone from walking into the hole as Mr. Dew did. We were able to argue to the jury that there was no negligence on Crown Derrick's part. What we were prevented from arguing is that even if the trial court found that those actions were negligent, it couldn't have been the causal effect of the injury because of all the activities that occurred.
Let me explore that just for a moment, and just the basis of an inferential rebuttal instruction as a whole. You say you were prevented from arguing on proximate cause. How did the absence of this instruction prevent you from making that argument?
And Justice Jefferson, I apologize if I misspoke. We certainly did the best that we could with the bad hand that was dealt to us and tried to argue around this issue as much as possible. What we were actually deprived of was a court's charge that properly charged the jury as to the law applicable to the facts of this case. And as this court held in Crown Life versus Castile, it is fundamental to our system of justice that parties have the right to be judged by a jury properly instructed in the law. That statement is supported once again in Harris County versus...
I'm struggling here. Tell me what you would have argued to the jury was the new and independent cause. Was it someone taking the rope down, or was it the fact that if someone took the rope down, someone else wouldn't have had a backup there?
It was a series of events, Your Honor, and I do need to make one factual distinction. The evidence in the record does support that there is at least one activity that occurred that no one is clear who did it, and that was the first act of taking the ropes down that Crown Derrick had erected. There's nothing in the record that says that Rowan did that, so to the extent that there's an issue of whether the actor that's in the new and independent cause is a party to the action or not, there's certainly evidence to support that someone other than a party to this case took the ropes down. But
y'all blamed it on Rowan.
Your Honor, we certainly blamed a lot of things on Rowan.
Well, I mean, your closing argument says it's 90% Rowan's fault if you find there's not a rope there. because Rowan let it be taken down.
That's certainly true. That's
and Rowan wasn't there closing argument, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. They had already settled.
So nobody for Rowan says, no, that's not true. So how were you prevented from arguing it's not our fault when you say it's Rowan's fault if you find there was no rope there and nobody from Rowan says otherwise?
Your Honor, we return to the idea that it's fundamental error, as this Court has found. We have a fundamental right for the jury to be properly charged.
Well, you said that at the beginning. The problem with this is it doesn't nudge the jury, and that's my question. Are you entitled to a nudge, particularly under comparative responsibility, where you've got all the people that could possibly have been at fault in the charge? The jury's asked, you know, did the negligence approximately cause? If so, how much of their negligence approximately cost? I mean, it seems like you've already gotten two bites at the apple. Why do you need a nudge?
Your Honor, number one, we're talking about two very different apples. Number one is the liability question. One is the comparative responsibility question. But we're not asking for a nudge. What we're asking, as this Court has consistently held, is only what we're entitled to, which is to receive a verdict from a jury that has been properly charged on the law as presented by the facts of that case.
I'm not sure he answered my question, or you were interrupted, I know, but I'm not sure what you claim the new and independent cause is. If it's someone removing the rope, isn't that the very basis of the negligence claim, that you put up something that could be so easily removed, and that's why OSHA requires a higher standard, and you agree to a higher standard? Not that someone took the rope down seems irrelevant to me.
Well, Your Honor, number one, there's disputed evidence in the record whether the ropes that were tied by Crown Derrick did, in fact, meet the OSHA standard, and we offered testimony that they did. But, again, we're not talking about just the ropes having been taken down. There's a series of events that occur. The ropes are taken down. An electrical junction box is placed over the hole. It's removed. Then a single rope barrier is tied across the hole that is a lack rope barrier. And then there's even evidence that by the time of Mr. Dew's fall, he fell. Now, the more important evidence that is also included in the record.
But all because you're alleged not to have properly secured it in the first instance.
No, Your Honor, I don't agree with that. Because the evidence in the record is that we did properly secure it, and we're talking about what you're talking about, I believe, is foreseeability. Could we foresee that maybe someone would have taken it down? But I think that misstates the foreseeability question here, because the other evidence in the record is that only a week before Mr. Dew's accident, Robert Rimlinger, who was Rowan's supervisor on the rig, was up on the rig. This was after a time that Crown Derrick's ropes had been removed, that the other changes had happened to the hull, and that now there was a single slack rope barrier that was slung across the hull. And the evidence was that Mr. Rimlinger saw that condition of the hull and did absolutely nothing to properly barricade the hull, and further did nothing to warn the workers who were going to be present up there. And under the Coleman case from the Dallas Court of Appeals and under the Restatement Third, if that's the direction that this court chooses to take, that is not foreseeable. It is not foreseeable that once Crown Derrick turned control of the rig over to Rowan and told Rowan specifically, we do not have the hardware necessary to hang the safety gates that would protect this ladder opening. And by the way, Justice Owen, I wanted to point out, this is not an opening that normally would be one that would be intended to be stepped around. This was a planned opening in the formal platform intended for a ladder to come up through it. So it was always intended.
Now, I want you to explain that for the record, because it was unclear to me. I couldn't tell if once the thing was finally finished, there would be a ladder beneath it, and you would open a gate at the same time, would lift the platform over the ladder, or would the ladder be always vertical? How would this look if it had been finished out like it was supposed to be?
Your Honor, my understanding is that there was never intended to be a latch that would raise up from the floor. What was intended, that you would come up the ladder into the hole, and there would be gates on either side of the hole as you came up. One of those gates would open, so that as you climbed the ladder, you would open the gate and step onto the platform.
So what if you don't? What if you just want to walk down the ramp, and you don't want to go up the ladder? What do you walk on in this space with the ladder there?
Well, Your Honor, there are two ladder openings on this formal platform. So it would allow access all the way around the formal platform, depending on which ladder you took up and which way the access gate was. In other words, if you climb up on the right side of the formal platform, let's say the gate swung this way, it would give you access to this part of the platform.
You were never supposed to walk through.
No, Your Honor, you were never.
That's my question. Is this just like a thing that you can normally you would loop around the ladder just off to your right and you would walk by it, or is it supposed to be a permanent barrier where you don't go beyond that barrier unless you're going up or down the ladder.
My understanding is that it was never intended to be something that was stepped around. It was intended to be a ladder opening into the portable platform. And design-wise, it would make sense as that was why there were two of these on this top platform to allow full access to the portable platform. But, Justice O'Neill, I want to return to your question because I think it's an important one, this idea of foreseeability. I don't want the foreseeability issue to be misstated because it's not foreseeable that given the fact that Mr. Rimlinger was on the portable platform less than a week before this accident and knowing that this was a danger unlike anything that Crown Derrick had left when it left the job site, that he took absolutely no actions
Let me try to see where you're going with this. Is your position that it doesn't matter how good or bad your original barrier was, you were entitled to a new independent cause because of the egregiousness of the subsequent actions?
That is correct, Your Honor. We believe it goes to two separate issues.
So whether you were negligent or not in tying the original barrier has no bearing, in your view, on whether you were entitled to this instruction.
That's absolutely correct, because the nature of new and independent cause would allow us to say to the jury with the court's specific instruction, the court has instructed you that even if you find that we were negligent in some way up to August 28th in leaving these rope barriers, even as, let's assume negligence, we still have no liability in this case because there is no proximate cause. Because as proximate cause would be defined, if in fact new and independent cause was submitted, proximate cause would say proximate cause is a cause unbroken by any new and independent cause, and then new and independent cause would be a separately defined term for the jury. The fact of the matter is, Texas case law is clear on at least one point, and that is, as even conceded by the petitioners, if the evidence in the case supports the submission of the inferential rebuttal issue of new and independent cause, and if the trial court refuses to give that instruction or that definition, then a party has been deprived of its right to have the jury properly charged on the law. And that is specifically important under this court's line of cases, such as Castile and such as Harris County versus Smith, because in this case, this court and no other appellate court has the opportunity to review the jury's verdict in such a way as to determine that the jury's negligence finding was based upon a valid theory. Because if the evidence supports new and independent cause, and if new and independent cause was not submitted such that the jury understood that there could be a causal break, then its finding of a yes as to the negligence of Crown Derrick may be based on an invalid theory.
So what is it that is not foreseeable? That the supervisor would see the problem and not correct it? That's what's not foreseeable?
I think that certainly is the primary foreseeability argument, Justice Jefferson. And the problem with this, as Justice Heck pointed out, was that we're talking about a hole that was designed to be in the platform, right? When in petitioner's argument, they said, well, they didn't do anything to permanently cover this hole. This hole was never intended to be permanently covered.
It was never intended to be walked over either. That's what we're trying to figure out here. What was it intended to be?
Absolutely. And the evidence in the record, Justice Owen, is that the rope barrier that was left by Crown Derrick would have prevented anyone from walking into the hole or walking across the hole.
But you just got through saying that doesn't matter to your argument.
That's correct. I'm just trying to respond to your inquiry. I apologize.
So you would have had to have done anything.
Taken to its logical extreme, Your Honor.
Even though you agreed to protect the hole and all that, you'd have no liability if you'd done nothing.
That is the very definition of new and independent cause, that our negligence had come to a rest or that it did nothing more than furnish the condition that led to the possibility of plaintiff's actions. That's how this court has time and time again defined the idea of new and independent cause. So taking your analogy or your factual scenario, you're absolutely correct. It's taking it to an extreme, and it certainly would make Crown Derrick look a lot worse in this case. But if, in fact, there was a causal break, if, in fact, there were actions that were taken by another party subsequent to the time that Crown Derrick had left the job site that operated to create
the causal break. And the action taken by the party is non-action.
That's correct. And so the Restatement Third and the Dallas Court of Appeals that I cited both specifically say that it does not necessarily have to be an action by a third party. It can be an omission.
So if only Rowan was in there, would they be entitled to new and independent cause for your failure to put the gates up?
Yes, Your Honor, I don't think there is anything in Texas law that would support the idea that once a party is named to a lawsuit as a defendant, that they lose the right to any causal break instruction. And that's really what petitioners have argued here. The new and independent cause is very different from, for example, sole proximate cause, which by definition applies only to actions of a party who is not a party to the lawsuit. New and independent cause has never been so defined.
Well, would Wolfslayer be entitled to two? One saying that you can look at what Crown Derrick did, and you can look at what Rowan did as new and independent causes.
No, Your Honor, because new and independent cause is not so narrowly defined. New and independent cause is defined in general terms. It simply says that if you find that the proximate cause unbroken by new and independent cause, you drop down to new and independent cause, and specifically the instruction that was requested defined a new and independent cause as it means the act or omission of a separate and independent agency, not reasonably foreseeable, that destroys the causal connection, if any, between the act or omission inquired about and the occurrence in question, and thereby becomes the immediate cause of such occurrence. So there would be no need for the specificity of two new and independent causes, but under this Court's precedential law, guaranteeing parties a fundamental right to receive a verdict based upon a jury's proper charging with the law.
But you're talking about but-for cause action, which is concurrent cause.
I'm sorry.
You're saying but-for Rowan's failing to do something, this wouldn't happen.
What the definition straight from the PJC refers to is something that destroys the causal connection.
But the jury could have interpreted that to apply to you, to Wolfslayer, and to Rowan. Is that correct?
That's potentially correct, Your Honor. It's not specifically defined.
So it wasn't limited to just you or to Wolfslayer. They could have decided that Rowan, too, there was some independent cause as to Rowan as well.
That's correct. I mean, the jury was charged with one charge, and this is an affirmative defense.
I'm talking about your requested instruction.
Yeah, that's correct, Your Honor. Wolfslayer actually requested the instruction as well, and I believe that they preserved their objection. They're not obviously a party to this appeal. But both Wolfslayer and Crown Derrick had requested and submitted this instruction on new and independent cause.
Further questions? Thank you.
May it please the Court, Mr. Will Powers, present rebuttal for petitioners.
May it please the Court. If it pleases the Court, I'd like to discuss three issues, three of which have been addressed in many of the questions. The first is what will trigger, even under the current PJC, trigger the new and independent cause, and we've heard a number of things. Mainly, it was so egregious by Rowe and things of that sort. What the current instruction says is that foreseeability is what triggers a new and independent cause instructor, just under the current PJC. Look at why they're negligent. They're negligent because it was temporary and could be taken down and not put back up. That's why Crown Derrick was negligent. If that negligence was to prevent some other kind of foreseeable events from happening, we don't know what they are. That's exactly what happened was why the jury found that they were negligent. It was temporary, and it could be moved. And it is, in my view, impossible to think of any other kind of reason for them to be negligent. So why they were negligent is exactly what happened. Under the new restatement, that's the approach. Under current nomenclature, under foreseeability and proximate cause, that's the approach. Foreseeability is the standard there. And they were asked, the jury was asked that question, not just in the breach issue. The jury was asked that question in the proximate cause issue. Was this a foreseeable result? It asked the exact same question as the new independent cause question. So it is redundant. And these little incrustations ought to be, and the new restatement says they ought to be reevaluated and taken out of the law. They're asking the same question.
When would it be proper to submit a new and independent cause instruction?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When would it be proper to submit a new and independent cause
instruction? Well, under the restatement, and in my view, both for reasons of not encrusting the charge with repetitive questions that can be confusing because the jury thinks we've been asked about foreseeability and proximate cause, we're being asked something else. we're supposed to be doing something different here, and it's the same question. And after comparative, a point that, I'd like to get to, I think this is not an instruction that, ought to be given. But in the old days, it would be given when the evidence raised the question that somebody was negligent, for example, rear-ending a car. The person whose car is rear-ended gets out, goes to a telephone to call in for a mechanic, and gets murdered. Now, that series of events is not the foreseeable kind of thing we think is going to happen because somebody gets rear-ended. And that's an unforeseeable consequence of that rear-end accident. It happened to involve an intervening cause. And under the current PJC, that would be the kind of case that would be a new and independent cause. But here, the very thing that they're claiming is the new and independent cause is the very reason this was foreseeable negligence in the first place.
Well, the restatement example, the excavation in the street that someone creates, right, and then a woman pushes the guy in there
purposely,
and under the restatement example, the person who created the hole would be liable. And how do you square that? Why wouldn't you be entitled to a new and independent cause instruction, or as a matter of law, new and independent cause under Texas law?
Well, if they're intentionally pushed in, right? Similarly, if I spill some gasoline on the ground, that somebody might inadvertently throw a match into it is part of the foreseeable risk that is part of the scope of liability. That an arsonist would come up and use that occasion to purposely.
But the restatement seems to say the opposite, and y'all are saying adopt the restatement. And the restatement seems to say that even if you intentionally push somewhere in the hole, the person that created the hole is liable.
No, I think the example says it might be a fact question.
Why would it be a fact question?
Well, because sometimes you create risks where it might be foreseeable that there are criminals around and would do intentional acts. If it were under circumstances where it was no reasonable line could differ as to whether it was an arsonist would foreseeably
what
do that.
What if there'd been horseplay on the ramp that day and a fellow worker had thrown him down the hole? What would be the circumstances?
I think that would raise a proximate cause question. I still would not submit new and independent cause because it's duplicative of the proximate cause.
Well, you would never submit new and independent cause.
Well, I think we win this case either way. I think for the reasons Justice Brister is pointing out and the reasons that we're now post-comparative, I think the new and independent is a confusing barnacle on the law and ought to be cleaned up, and that's what the
restatement provides. Well, let me put it this way. Would you suggest to us that the way we should deal with my example, let's suppose everybody had done exactly what had happened here, except that for reasons that were not clear, the hole was open and a worker intentionally pushed Mr. Duke through it. Now,
yes.
Would you handle that in this court as a matter of law, that's a new independent cause based on this evidence? Not for take it away from the jury, or would you just submit it to the jury? How would you handle that?
If
and
there
the jury
was no evidence of criminal behavior by people around the jury, then I think just like this court did in Lear Siegler and Union Pump, that as a matter of law, I'd say that that's no proximate cause. But you don't need a new and independent cause submission.
That's my that's my question. Are you suggesting the court handle those situations where there really either with the evidence either there is clear evidence of independent cause or not? If there is, is it so clear as a matter of law? Otherwise, let the jury just decide.
Correct. And here it is so clear that there's proximate cause as a matter of law. But in any event, you can do all of that as the court did in Lucy or as the court did in Union Pump. There it was producing cause rather than proximate cause. You can do all that within the proximate cause instruction and fact-finding. You don't need a new and independent cause.
What were your other two points?
Well, I'd just like to pick up on the reason, the restatement in Section 34, comments C and D, and I encourage the court to read that and the reporter's notes to that, characterizes new and independent or superseding causes as a holdover from the pre-comparative negligence days when there was joint and several liability on every single actor who was at all involved. And there was contributory negligence as an absolute part. It was an all-or-nothing approach. And it was important to have doctrines that pointed to the really culpable people as opposed to the more tangentially culpable people. Once we've gone to comparative negligence, the comparative instructions and the comparative findings can do that. And we don't have joint and several liability. So the historical source of this idea of superseding causes and new and independent causes goes back to that all or nothing approach, and there's no need for it. And just the two cases, we can provide you with cites on them. A case out of the Fifth Circuit, Campbell, written by Judge Jones, and a Seventh Circuit case, the Justice case, and we'll provide the court with cites to those, written by Justice Posner, who say exactly the same thing, that in post-comparative, there's no need for a new and independent or superseding or special doctrine, that the regular proximate cause instruction along with the comparative findings. And we'll provide the court with those.
Your final point?
That was going to be my final.
Have any other courts, any other states adopted the scope of liability concept in your state?
The nomenclature. Not that I know of, although it's pretty new. And the reason for the nomenclature change.
So new, it hasn't even been adopted.
Sorry?
It's so new, it hasn't even been adopted.
Well, it has been it's been adopted by the membership. It hasn't come out as a final draft. The nomenclature part is to get around this idea of leaks in the chain of causation, breaks in the chain of causation, recurring causes, new and independent causes. Those terms are just conclusions, and they don't provide the jury with any help at all. And that's the reason for the moment.
Any further questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn.